Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening from Fort Lauderdale. This is Nate Klarfeld with Stonewall Live, the best of gay and lesbian book, film, and media talk on Blog Talk Radio. Tonight I have David Berger, author of Task Force Gaia, Finding Balance, the first of a series of science fiction mythology books written by a English teacher, AP, high school AP and IB, which we're going to do those little initials and tell what they mean in a minute, college professor, hibernophile, I like Guinness beer, avid reader of fantasy fiction. Welcome, David. How are you tonight?
I'm doing well, thanks, Nate. How are you?
That's the strangest introduction. I wrote one, but I decided not to read it. So there you go. David, your book is obviously science fiction from the looks of it. I've on my blog and on our looking at the cover. How did you get started in science fiction?
Well, I think the best place to start for me was as a child when I started reading comic books. And at the same time, I think I was also getting into Greek mythology when I was in school. And the two of them just sort of coalesced.
Right.
And I started getting into reading that and then started writing little bits at a time, I mean, when I was younger.
So you've been writing all your life, all 29 years, right?
29 years, yes, thank you.
That's what you look like in the picture. Well, you know, a lot of comic books, I, of course, read comic books as a kid, didn't get as interested in Greek mythology, did what I had to in school. But a lot of, later on when I got interested and read some stuff, I found out that a lot of comic book heroes, like your heroes, are very similar to mythology, both in their genesis, both in their powers, and both in their moral type things. Do you want to talk about that a little bit, about the morality of some of these Greek heroes?
Well, it's interesting because a lot of times you hear about the Greek gods, and they really don't have a lot of morals. The gods themselves, they're pretty much petty, and they play with mortal lives, and I wanted to change that a little bit. And one of the characters in the book, who is Apollo, who's the sun god, I tried to make him put in a position where he becomes human and to deal with his own mortality and realize that while I can't think the same way as I did when I was a god on Mount Olympus, I now have to approach everyday issues like hunger and pain and remorse and grief and deal with those issues. And the heroes that stem from him, or that are later on in the book, one of them is his son. He has to also learn some of those lessons the hard way too.
So they're human, but they have powers. They have to learn how to use them amongst the humans. Right. Great. Okay. So we're going to go into you're a teacher, and your students obviously know that you're a writer because you do not use a nom de plume. You write under your real name. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's correct.
How do they react to that when they find out their teacher is a published writer?
Well, this year was interesting because this is the first year I started actually. I published the book in February, so this was a new set of students. And I have a movie poster-sized book cover of my room, and they came in and said, "Oh, are you the same David Berger who wrote the book?" I said, "Uh-huh." And then from that point on, they were just completely and utterly amazed that their very own English teacher was a published author at the same time.
Right, right. It's kind of like you're a little rock star there. It gave you a little cred.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it does. I know. It's just amazing. I would have given you a lot of cred. It's a lot of work, you know, writing. Let's see. Your bio says high school AP. We all know that means advanced placement. Tell us a little bit about the IB program at your school, what it stands for and what you do for it with it.
The IB program is International Baccalaureate, which really is very similar to AP, except on a more international level. It's throughout the world there are schools that have the IB program, and the difference really is that in IB, the students are juniors and seniors in devoted coursework for those 2 years, whereas AP, they can pick and choose which classes they want to take.
Yeah, I see. Good, good. So they have all their classes have to like coordinate and be super, not just AP science. Like I was AP science. I only did science stuff, but I'd have to do science, English, math. Oh, so you got the real smart kids, don't you? Ooh. Okay. So that's why they're interested in you. Okay. I'm just kidding. So I have had about 13, 14 years in gay literature, speaking to hundreds of authors, reading books every week. I have a lovely life. I love it. And I have noticed a disproportionate, almost, I've been to Trekkie conventions because of this little job with Stonewall Live. What draws gay people to science fiction? What is your take on that?
I think that when gay people, especially people who are not comfortable with coming out, they look at something that they see some certain heroes who are, you know, in society are sometimes shunned because of what they can do, or they're sort of, you know, looked upon as freaks of nature. And I think the gay community, many people, many times, I know I didn't have this experience, but a lot of people have that experience where they're looked down upon as well. And whether you're gay or you have superpowers, in whatever universe you live in, people look at you and think that you're just not right with the world. And I know some people will identify mm-hmm. with that. I know I didn't have that problem growing up, really, but I know that I personally felt disconnected. And I know comic books and then the idea of having superpowers and rising above your own problems, I certainly wished that maybe I had those powers as a kid so that I could be more or be mm-hmm. accepted or be able to come out and say, hey, you know, this is who I am. Mm-hmm. So I think it's more of the ability of having the power behind yourself to say, this is my identity.
This is who I am. I'm better. I've got the super thing. I'm really super. I've got the super little secret. And the other thing that, you know, I'm married to, many of my listeners know this, I'm married to a psychiatrist in the gay community, and I throw things at him all the time. I ask him these questions all the time. And one of his quote-unquote theories is it's kind of the same reason why a lot of the early comic books were written by Jews. They kind of felt persecuted, and this was something that they were attracted to for exactly what you just said, is that this was they were always looked at funny, they were always never fit in, they couldn't always show that what they had to people. So it's very similar, but it's funny that he picked up the Jewish thing. He did that when he converted. I have a convert, a husband who's a wonderful, wonderful man, but he has everything is in that realm now, that he looks at things now from a persecuted level, even though he's a blonde haired, blue eyed Texan from, you know, Baptist family. But we love him anyway. He's laughing at me right now. All right, so I'm going to do a little plug for your book right now. It's available at Amazon.com and Smashwords. Everyone knows how to get to those, Barnes and Noble. David also has a website, and I'm going to spell it out for everybody tonight. It's taskforce-gaia.com. That's taskforce-gaia.com. Gaia is one of those words. Once you learn how to spell it, you'll be fine. Right, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So were you always a storyteller? If I asked your siblings, if you have any, if you were the big storyteller, would they say that you and the family, you were the big storyteller?
I think so. I mean, as a kid, my sisters and I used to write stories together, and one of my sisters was into Smurfs, and we used to write stories together about that when we were kids. And I think they've always known that I like to write. I've always been an English person, so I've always been that way. So, and they've known about this story and this book for a long time. So I think, I think they would say that I'm definitely a storyteller.
Good. I've heard that from many people, especially your stories obviously are not autobiographical. I mean, I don't think you were ever born with an amulet or given a sword or a javelin with many powers up at the Lakes, Florida, though I don't know. It could be a strange place. And you could have, you know, so you're definitely writing from total, total, wonderful, wonderful imagination. I love it. I had a fun time with it. I love your website because the first thing is on your website, you're such a devoted writer. Do you know what he has on his website? Of course, your next book is going to be Memory's Curse. This one's Finding Balance, book one. Book two is Memory's Curse. I'm being the dramatic voice here. And you are giving us the word count on Memory's Curse as you write it. Isn't that hilarious? What made you do that? I've never seen that before.
I think part of it's for me. I think the blog is for people who want to visit, but also to to show me and keep me going. It was more of a process blog when I first started writing and just posting randomly about what I was doing or how much progress I'd made. And I stumbled upon a website that had a word count counter that I could throw up there and add to it. And I think it's good for me to help me be able to see exactly how far I've come without, you know, you open up a Word document, you see a word count, it doesn't mean anything.
Right,
you
right.
Visualize it. But on a thermometer, you can see approximately where I'll be. And so it makes it a little more sense as I go along.
And also, I've seen it now. So I know that we're going to say, when are we going to have the interview on Memory's Curse? Let's see. So keeps you honest. That's fun. That's really fun. I just want to remind anyone out there listening, I've got a couple of people in the chat room. I've got four people in the chat room chatting with each other, not me. if they want to call in, the number to call in to ask our guest, David Berger, any questions is 805-830-8355. We were having a little technical difficulty earlier, but it looks like it's all better out there. The temperature has dropped dramatically here in Fort Lauderdale. We've got some lightning and stuff, so you never know with my Comcast hookups. Okay, let's go back to our characters. We had some fun characters. I would say you've got male characters, you've got female characters. Of course, your drawings that are on the website make them very hunky, of course, and very butch. The girls are butch and femme. They're just so cute. Who did those drawings?
I ran into an artist on a comic book artist website about 10 years ago named Michael Hamlet. Huh. And it was one of those matches made in heaven because I gave him the idea and said, here, I want to do some artwork, original sketches, just for inspiration for me as I'm writing. And I said, here's the description of one, and let me see what you do. And I've given a few different people this as well to pick someone. And he sent back the sketch to me, and it was exactly the way I had pictured this character.
Huh. Right, right.
And so he did the other three.
Huh?
The other three for me. And then after that, 10 years later, I'm writing finishing the novel. And I said, would you be interested in doing the cover? He said, well, I don't do sketch work the same way. I do it more computer, based on the computer graphics. And so he sent me, I gave him, again, the sketches back to him and said, here's what you did 10 years ago. And he gave me the cover image that you see. And again, first time out, fell in love with it.
Oh, my God, it's fabulous. I would have never guessed that this was not a somebody like Chip Kidd, one of those professional cover guys that works for like Random House or something. Your cover is absolutely amazing. It has the four main characters on them. Danielos Fairmont, who is our the one who has the Eye of Gaia, the gem that allows the bearer to use boundless visions to open a portal into any place he's been. Brandon Jeffries, and he has the amulet, the Eye of I'm thinking I'm pronouncing this wrong, Uranus, did I say
right, yeah, Uranus. Mm-hmm.
That helps him channel the parts of the Zodiac. Has our femme lady, Sarah Bishop, and she has the ring that belonged to an ancient king, and she's a potter, which I think is too cool, because potters use their hands, and then you stuck a ring on her finger, and you never see a ring, so we got to talk about the ring. And then you have Austin, our butch, very, very butch girl with a bared midriff. She had a midriff on the cover, too, and she has a genetic mistake, a la Green Lantern or Spider-Man, and has has the spirit of an eagle and a magic javelin that allows her to channel Zeus lightning. Is that right? Did I get that right? I have it with my notes.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you got these four dudes, two dudes and two gals that are coming together. What up? What happened? What happens when all four of these people meet?
Well, they meet up separately. They didn't know each other before, and fate sort of draws them all together, because in the past the gods, mess around with humanity, and of course Zeus about to taking over Mount Olympus, one of the ancient goddesses is left out of the equation. He doesn't go to her. So down the line, which he's destroyed these scales that keep everything in balance in the universe, and thousands of years later no one has been able to restore the balance until prophecies say that four mortals would have to come together to do it, and they're given special gifts, like you said, to be able to go up against whatever power the world puts before them to eventually have to put the scales back together. But they know that if they do that, it will rewrite history once more. History's changed a bit since the scales are no longer in balance, and they might not exist if they do that.
Right.
So it, do you give up your own life for the benefit of the world around you, or do you just say, forget it, I'll just deal with chaos? And they make, obviously they have to make a choice as heroes, but they're not used, this is not like they grew up that way, at least for the most part. They didn't grow up with these powers. They didn't have this to, like some heroes grew up, like Superman grows up from birth, learning how to be eventually a Superman. These people have to deal with, as adults, suddenly being power thrust upon them, kind of like what you said, like Spider-Man.
Right, right. But really, that's the earlier what I mentioned, the thing about the morals. I think this is what I was getting to, these moral questions that these heroes have. But I did not, you know, I did not put it together that, yes, they were not born with those. So, yes, they were mortal first, and then they were given immortal powers and immortal insight, because they can see into things and have visions. So that does make sense, and that and I did not want to give more plot away. That's enough plot, okay? We want them to buy the book.
Yes.
I know. Again, I'm going to do a little. It's time for another plug. I've got a little timer going for me here. It's Task Force Gaia, G-A-E-A, Finding Balance, Book 1 by David Berger, available on Amazon.com, Smashwords, Barnes & Noble, and his own website, Task Force Gaia.com, and you'll really enjoy this book. It's a great read. You will go to your little mythology handbook, which you probably had in college and threw away, but I had to go like online and find out who all these old mythology books people were, because I forgot them. But now I'm good. All right, let's get back to a couple of questions that I had. One is, you're a hibernophile, which you're going to explain to us, right?
Yes. I love Ireland. I went just after grad school to visit a friend of mine, and I fell in love. And I have no Irish history or family anywhere.
Uh-huh.
I just fall in love with it. And I've been back there a number of times. In fact, every time I've been back since was to take students on tours of like England, Ireland, and Wales, but mostly Ireland has been a great love of mine for a long time.
Good, good. And so that's how that started. Yes, I only like Guinness beer. Is that okay? That's enough?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Me too.
Oh, my God. Okay. And you work full-time teaching these kids and in an IB program and an advanced placement, which I did teach high school for a very short period of time as a second career, and I can tell everyone out there, I worked 60, 80 hours a week when I was a practicing dentist, a children's dentist, and then when I went into a second career, I'm in my fourth right now. That was the hardest job I ever had all my life. Did you want to be an English teacher all your life?
I would say 98% of my life. I think college was – I wanted to be a lawyer for about a year and a half, and then realized that wasn't what I had a calling to do.
Uh-huh.
And I switched from a political science major to an English major and fell in love with English again, and thought, you know, I wanted to help kids actually as a lawyer, be a family court attorney.
Uh-huh. Great.
My parents divorced when I was very young, and it was hard growing up that way, and I wanted to do something with children to help them. But one or two families at a time didn't seem right. And as an English major, I thought, well, I like the idea of teaching, so I'll explore that. And then when I was in graduate school, it just clicked, and I've been doing it. This is my 20th year of teaching now.
Very good for you. I lasted three. And I didn't kill anybody or hurt anybody. I was a biology, chemistry, and physics teacher, and I did have an AP class. My school was not an IB school. It was actually an inner-city school that had a lot of input from the University of Kansas. I'm a Midwesterner, and so we had a lot of stuff. But I did that because one of those things where I'm 63 years old, and I was caught up in the whole Vietnam draft thing, and I said, I'm not going to get drafted. So I became a dentist and did it for 25 years, loved it. Had a great time. I was a children's dentist. I also wanted to help children. And then when I became financially independent, I left and became a teacher. And it was a very eye-opening experience, and my hat is off to you for doing this for 20-something years, because it is literally the hardest job I have ever had. It's the hardest thing I've ever done. It's like you have to put on a production every hour on the hour, every single day. I called it 900 performances a year.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly what it is.
It is. Acting is nothing, honey. Broadway is nothing. I think there's even a book called 900 Performances a Year. That was an old book I had when I was in graduate school. Anyway, forget it. All right, back to another question I had from the chat room. This is a good one. What do you say to a prospective reader who says, "I'm not a fan of sci-fi"?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think I'd want to know why, first of all, why they're not a fan of it. I know people are either sci-fi or fantasy. A few people are both, but I know some people who are very Star Trek aren't very Greek myth. I've seen that. I don't know. That's a difficult question. If you're not interested in the supernatural, or you're not interested in the scientific, the possibilities of science going beyond what we see today, then that's, I guess you're just not interested in that. I mean, I have students who are very much the same way. They don't.
Right.
They look at my book and think, "Oh, well, it sounds interesting, but it's just not my genre." In fact, my partner has been starting to read it. I guess he read it back in February. He's not even halfway through. He's not a fantasy reader. So he's just left it, you know, for a while.
Well, I did the same thing to a very close friend who's another gay sci-fi writer, who actually his characters are more openly gay than yours, and have a lot of gay straight conflicts in their books. And when I first got to know him very, very well, and this is what he did on the side, or actually now he does this full time, I told him I never read sci-fi before. I'm not a fan of sci-fi. And here's what he said to me. He said, "You know, everything you see in imagination, it's your imagination. Let your imagination go, and what you wanted to be as a kid and what you want to do," just like we were talking about the supernatural powers. And I started to think back of being a child, and yet be adult enough to look at the consequences of those powers, you know, being able to zap people or have X-ray vision or fly around. And he just started me thinking like that. And I started to be a fan. In fact, I ended up being his blurb on one of his books on his back cover. I wrote one of the blurbs, and it's a big hit. And my name is like, I can go to bookstores and pull it out and show my people. So I asked that question once, actually, myself, and I just remembered that, and he told me, he said, it's part of your imagination that you just kind of tuck away, you know, kid stuff, you know, everybody, and this is what he said to me. He said, everybody has put on a Superman cape and pretended they were Superman with a blanket or a towel. And that's the same thing as science fiction. So you just kind of reach back, and that's what that's my answer to the person in the chat room. Chatter. Oh, you're in the chat room now. Chatter 11078. Okay. Hi, David. You're in the chat room. Hello.
Hi.
Anyway, let us see what's going on. I think they come and go. So let me ask another question. How are you promoting this book? What's changed in publishing for you? I mean, this is your first book, but you said you wrote it for 10 years. Took you 10 years in the process? Is that right?
Sort of. I mean, it started as a high school short story, and so it started more than 25 years ago, but about 10 or 12 years was the last 10 or 12 was really the focus of getting it finished and finalizing the manuscript. And at 40, I said, I'm done. I have to finish it at 40, and then wherever I am at that point, I'll edit it and then put it out there. And that's basically what I had to do. Otherwise, I think I'd still be writing it now.
Right, right. Deadlines are – that's why you're not – that your deadlines are so important. So what did you do when you finished the book? How did you get it into print?
I went through – a friend of mine mentioned about CreateSpace, which is an on-demand publishing service through Amazon.com. And it was a no cost to me. It's not a vanity press where I have to pay for copies to be made. And I give them the materials, a PDF file of the book and a cover image, and they create the Amazon page. And it goes from there. And then I'm, of course, you know, in charge of then promoting through Twitter and Facebook, and I go to conventions, comic book and sci-fi conventions, to promote it as well. So I do whatever I can to get it out there. Local newspaper articles. I go to book fairs in the Land O'Lakes area, Tampa area. So it's, you know, as you said, teaching is a very busy, demanding schedule, and so I have to find the time to make the time to promote as well.
Until this is pitched to brought to Hollywood, right, and then you'll be fine.
Well, you know, it's funny you should say that, because I went to very funny you should mention that. I went to BentCon, which is an LGBT sci-fi fantasy convention out in L.A. in November, and I met a gentleman who is an actor who I didn't understand why he was chatting with me at first, but long story short, he is an actor who has a production company who is interested in making a film of the book.
Oh, wow. Oh, my goodness.
We're in talks to set up a film treatment right now. We're just going to get the contract finalized so I can write the film treatment that he will then shop around to studios out there, and then we'll go see where it goes.
So you will have time, because you'll have like a limo and a Bentley, right?
Yeah, exactly.
If there's anyone out there listening, let me just really quickly explain. The old-fashioned book publishing with an agent, an editor, a publishing house, a hardback or a trade paperback book, which is what I believe this is, the author would make less than $2 or $3 per book. With this on-demand publishing, or even some of the self-publishing, or the e-books, the author is in full control, of course, without an editor, but also makes more money per book, which is a really, really good thing, because it's getting more and more people into different genres that they wouldn't have gotten into. It's getting more and more people out there. And you do have to be out there. You have to go to the conventions. You have to have the blogs. You have to have the Twitters. You have to have the people who have bought your book. You need to be in contact with them. You have to have a way of contacting them. It's a whole new world. As many of you know, that many gay publishers have gone out of business. We only have, I believe, one or two left. Is that right? Do you keep track? I keep track.
I think, there are very few. I think you're about right on that one or two left.
That's it. And the rest of them are even suggesting that you do go to something either on demand or a self-publishing type thing. So what we have to do really is to just promote ourselves. And it is a democratization of the whole industry. So you're doing great. You're doing good. I think this book – first of all, I did not know – I did not look at who published it. I never do that. I just kind of look at the book right when I get it in the mail. I get free books in the mail. It's a great job. And I said, wow, this is a pro, because a lot of the books aren't. And the book is written beautifully. You can tell it's written by an English professor. Again, Task Force Gaia, Finding Balance by David Berger, available on Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, Smashwords, and, of course, David Berger's website, www.taskforce-gaia.com, and Gaia is spelled G-A-E-A. How many people do you know that don't know how to spell that word?
Actually, too many. They'll spell it in so many different ways. But how do you spell that? It's like it's G-A-E-A. Oh, that's not how it sounds. Oh, okay. I don't know how you're thinking it's spelled, but so.
Gaia. Come on. Even my son, I have a son who's an Ivy League graduate, Wharton graduate, beautiful kid, went to law school. I get texts from him that that are like so illiterate, and I get want to shoot him and strangle him, because I was like, I was like beaten to death in private school with, commas and semicolons and dangling participles, and the kid's just horrible. All right. So we've got about 90 seconds left. This has been the fastest 30 minutes of your life, as always. What would you say to a young writer that walked up to you in person and said, David Berger, I want to be you. How do I do it?
Just continue to write. Don't let anything stop you. Don't stop to edit. Write your ideas out there and just keep going. And then eventually you'll see your story unfold, and your story will tell you what it wants to say.
Uh-huh.
And then at some point you'll find a place to stop, and you'll go from there. But just keep writing.
Just keep writing every day. Do you write every day?
I try to write at least one day, once a day, if not at least 4 days a week, a little bit, like an hour at a time.
So it's like a job. It's like, yeah, it's like a little regular, like a workout. It's your workout.
Yeah, it is.
It sounds like a great workout. That's super. So, again, Task Force Gaia, Finding Balance, David Berger. We have 20 seconds left, so I'm going to just say goodnight from Fort Lauderdale. David, any last words?
Well, the sequel will be out in late spring, and you'll have more geek characters in that book, I promise.
That's what I was wanting to hear. Look for the sequel, Memories Cursed by David Gaia. Good night for Fort Lauderdale. Thank you, David.
Thank you very much, Nate.
Bye-bye. There you go.